Right, our second session is O Theophilus. Our speaker is Brother John Launchbury. This is day five at the 57th New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our second period speaker is Brother John Launchbury on O Theophilus. The subtitle for today is The Jewish Messiah. This is the fourth talk in his series. Brother John.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground already, and I said that what we're going to do in this session is start looking at some of the objections to what I laid out as a way to think about Luke's gospel, Luke's writings that he writes to Theophilus. And in particular, what we're going to do today is look at the role of Luke's gospel as a defense and explore that. Just to remind us where we started from, we started with Luke and Acts, both written to Theophilus, the first one using his official title, Most Excellent Theophilus, and then the second one calls him O Theophilus. I wrote about all that Jesus began to do and teach. So we've been arguing that Luke Acts was written for Paul's defense. Two major objections to this idea. One is from manuscript dating. Don't most people say Luke was written around 80 AD? And if Luke was written around 80 AD, then Acts was written later. And it's a little bit late for Paul, whose trial was in 62 AD. It's coming some 20 years too late. Then the second objection is all the religious content. Why would the trial need anything of what's in the gospel? So in this class, we'll focus on the first of these questions, but we will spend some time looking at how Luke may have selected his material, selected his content. I'd like to have us notice immediately what Luke says here about his gospel and the process by which he constructed it. He says at the end of this first paragraph, the things that were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. One of the things we immediately notice from that is Luke himself is not claiming to be an eyewitness. Do you notice that? What he's saying is, I'm talking to people who were eyewitnesses, and I'm gathering all of their information. It's a big contrast in Scripture to those who were eyewitnesses, like Peter, like John, that which we have seen. You know, John is really clear about, I was an eyewitness to it. Peter's very clear about that. The other apostles, in fact, one of the attributes of being appointed an apostle in Acts 1 was that this person could independently and personally witness to things. And even Paul claims eyewitness status because of the personal revelations that went to him. He became an eyewitness of the resurrected Christ. But he talks about as one who was born late. But Luke is not. Interestingly, the writer to the Hebrews, I think we can also conclude, is not when we look carefully there. Luke is one of the ones who is a second-hand person. And Luke is saying here that I'm more like an investigator. I wasn't a witness. But what I did was I found witnesses, and I talked to witnesses, these things that were handed down from those who were witnesses. And I get the sense from Luke that he's probably looking for multiple witnesses for things. What he's doing, as we've seen, is building a verifiable account. And he says at the end, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you have been taught. Or of the things that you've been told. Like, I've given you a verbal account before. Now I want to have something constructed with all the evidence so that you are confident on it. Now, one of the things that we notice when we look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke is, first of all, a couple of things. Matthew and Luke are both kind of large compared with Mark. These circles are approximately to scale for the material in there. There's also a lot of overlap between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So this is what the overlap looks like. And if we make it transparent, you can see this sort of fancy Venn diagram. Remember you did Venn diagram, you know, hundreds of years ago in school? So the we started out with Matthew being red and Luke being blue. So the overlap just between Matthew and Luke is a kind of purple. Okay, makes sense? And Mark is coming in as yellow. And so the bits that Mark overlaps with Matthew is orange, and the bits that Mark overlaps with Luke is green. And then where they all overlap has become kind of like a muddy gray. So that's how it is. The percentages here, what I did was looked at the total material in all the Gospels, called that 100%. In these three Gospels, I wasn't counting John. In these three Gospels, and looked at what percentage of that total material is in all of them, is in just Matthew, is in just Luke, is in Matthew and Luke. So these are approximate percentages across all the material in the three Gospels. So one of the things that immediately strikes us is how little there is in just Mark and nothing else. Only 1% of the material in all of those three Gospels only occurs in Mark. Everything else occurs in Luke or in Matthew or in both of them as well. So that's kind of cool. In the overlap between things, often people have exactly the same wording. And that raises the question, how did that happen? How did you end up with exactly the same wording? And so people have spent a lot of time thinking about that. And in particular, as we look at these Gospels, a very natural question starts to arise. Which of these Gospels came first? To what extent did one Gospel writer have access to another Gospel as they're writing them? How does it all piece together? How did these various authors construct their Gospels? And I've been talking a lot about how Luke constructed things. Now I'm talking about how Matthew and the others constructed things. I'll talk in the final talk about how inspiration works on all this. Even though I'm talking about how people constructed it, I still naturally believe that the Spirit of God has a major, major role in guiding what happens. But I also have the viewpoint that the individual themselves have a major role in guiding it. So when you read Paul, it sounds different than when you read Peter, than when you read John, and so on. The individual person and the circumstance and so on all plays a part. So we're going to look at how did the authors construct their Gospels and why. Various early Christian writers describe what they had learned about the origins of the Gospels. Here's a writer called Papias. He was the leader of the church at Smyrna. He was born just a couple of years before Paul's trial. So he was a toddler running around when Paul was on trial. And he lived for, not a bad time. I mean, he could have been close to 100 years old. These dates are approximate. We don't know for sure. So here's something. We've got fragments of his writing that have been preserved in other people's writings. He says, "When a person came who had been a follower of the elders, I would inquire about the discourses of the elders, what was said by Andrew or by Peter or by Philip or by Thomas or James or by John or Matthew or any of the other Lord's disciples, and what Aristion and the elder John, the disciples of the Lord, say. For I did not think that I could get so much profit from the content of books as from the utterance of a living and abiding voice." He carries on a little bit later. "And the elder said also this." This is the one he calls the elder John. "Mark, having become the interpreter of Peter, wrote down accurately everything he remembered, without, however, recording in order either what was either said or done by Christ. For neither did he hear the Lord," that is Mark, "nor did he follow him, but afterwards he attended Peter, who adapted his instruction to the needs of his hearers, but had no design on giving a connected account of the Lord's oracles. So then Mark made no mistake while he thus wrote down some things as he remembered them, for he made it his one care not to omit anything he heard, nor to set down any false statement therein." So here's an early record that says how Mark's gospel came to be. It says Mark wasn't an eyewitness of Jesus. Peter clearly was. And what Mark would do was follow around Peter and listen to the things that Peter was saying and write them down. And so what we have in Mark, according to Papias, is Peter's eyewitness account the things Peter himself witnessed and could bear testimony to. So one of the things that people look at when they think about the Gospels is, well, Mark's the shortest Gospel, so maybe that was the one that came first. And so this is a hypothesis called the two-source hypothesis, and you'll see why in a moment. And it comes on this reasoning. Mark is the shortest Gospel. The shortest Gospel is likely to have come first and then others added material. So that means Mark comes first. In theological circles, that's called Markan priority, that Mark was the one that had priority. It came first from the others. And this two-source hypothesis that we'll go through assumes Markan priority, that Mark came first and the others built upon it. And the hypothesis was very popular in the last half of the last century, and now it's starting to come under a bit of challenge. In fact, I'm going to challenge it as well today. But I want to tell you what it is, just so that you have a context of what I'm challenging. So the idea is that Mark was there, and then Matthew and Luke would have built upon this basis, and that now they're larger because they've added material. There are variants which say that Matthew built upon it, and then Luke had access to Matthew and he had access to Mark while he was writing his, which is, you know, entirely plausible given what Luke said about gathering all the stuff together. However, one of the challenges that we saw is that there's a huge body of material. Remember that purple piece that was in Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark? And the question is, where did that come from? Where did that purple, how did they end up with the same thing there? And so the two-source hypothesis hypothesizes another document called Q, in German for quell, apparently, but the idea is for the quotations of Jesus. There's a lot of quotations of Jesus that are hypothesized to be in this document, and that was used in order to generate, both Matthew and Luke use that as a source. So one of the challenges for us with this is that Mark appears to have been written around 64, 65 AD, something like that, when Peter was in Rome. And so if Mark came first, that immediately pushes Matthew and Luke into the 70s or the 80s, and we end up with a problem that I started with. Very natural conclusion from what we had here. So the challenge here, there's a couple of challenges, hence the but at the bottom of the slide. First of all, one has to hypothesize this document Q that was around. Now, we have no copies of Q. Well, there's lots of things that we have no copies of. But not only do we have no copies of Q, nobody even mentions it in any of the things. So nobody even says there's a document of these quotations or things like that. So Q, a lot of people have been very worried about hypothesizing Q for these kinds of reasons. Then for us, the challenge, as I say, is that Matthew and Luke being very late, and Luke being very late in particular, conflicts with the defense theory that we've seen for Luke. Now, of course, if Luke's gospel is late, then the defense theory is wrong. But on the other hand, we've seen a huge amount of evidence so far for the defense theory, which it should be added to say, well, maybe we got the date of Luke wrong, and we should consider a different possibility for the date of Luke. And what's also interesting is that there are other ancient witnesses who say that Matthew and Luke did not come after Mark. In fact, came before them. So here's Clement of Alexandria. This is about 100 years or so after Paul. And he says this: the earliest Gospels were those containing the genealogies. Which ones contain the genealogies? Well, Matthew and Luke. So he's saying Matthew and Luke are the earliest Gospels, while Mark's originated as follows, And then he tells a similar story. When at Rome, Peter had openly preached the word and by the Spirit had proclaimed the gospel, the large audience urged Mark, who had followed him for a long time and remembered what had been said, to write it all down. This he did, making his gospel available to all who wanted it. When Peter heard about this, he made no objection and gave no special encouragement. Last of all, aware that the physical facts had been recorded in the Gospels, encouraged by his pupils and irresistibly moved by the Spirit, John wrote a spiritual gospel. So that's how Clement, 100 years after the events that we're looking at, wrote it down. He says Matthew and Luke were earliest, Mark was derived from Peter, and then John assumed that people had access to these physical, the documents that talked about the physical things that took place, and wrote what he calls a spiritual gospel. So there is a viable account for the construction of the Gospels, which takes into account these kinds of ancient witnesses and places all of the Gospels before the destruction of Jerusalem, before AD 70. And it fits with contextual clues that we have within Luke and Acts. For example, that the author had been to these places. So let's look at one of the hypotheses, the most popular one, which places Matthew and Luke earlier. So based on the ancient testimony, and we'll see some more testimony, that actually suggests that Matthew was the one written first, and that Luke was written with access to Matthew. So Matthew's gospel is there. Luke now is doing his, one of the sources that he uses in order to write his history of the Jewish Messiah was Matthew. And then what Mark did was captured the eyewitness account of Peter, but had access to Matthew and Luke as he did it. So Peter has been talking about things. Peter has access to these, and that's sufficient to explain a lot of the common wording. And of course, if the wording was word for word correct, that makes sense as well. And then John writes after them all. But this still has some challenges. It leaves some explaining to do, like why did Luke omit parts of Matthew? Why is Mark shorter than both? Well, I think it's easy to say why might Mark be shorter, because if his goal was just to capture Peter's eyewitness account, he wouldn't write down things that Peter didn't witness. And there's lots in Matthew and Luke that Peter himself didn't witness. So if the intent of Mark's gospel is, I'm going to capture what Peter the eyewitness was saying, then of course it's going to be shorter. And as we'll see, Mark put a few things in there that may actually have been him as an eyewitness as well. And we'll just touch on that at the end. I think the explanation for why Luke omitted parts of Matthew, the defense hypothesis we've been exploring, is actually really helpful there. Because what it does is it shows reasons why Luke might have chosen to leave out some parts that are in Matthew and put in different parts because they're going to be relevant. First of all, maybe he didn't want some of these other things being in a legal document going to Rome. And maybe they weren't defensible, weren't verifiable. But on the other hand, he's put other things in that are particularly relevant. So we're going to look at this. So here was the picture of all three of them. But let's imagine we're dealing with before Mark is written. So let's take Mark out of the picture and now just look at Matthew and Luke. So here's the Matthew circle, here's the Luke circle. And what we'll notice from this, if we started out with Matthew, Luke uses about two-thirds of Matthew as he's constructing his gospel. So he looks at Matthew and yep, 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 no, yep, no, no, yep, no. And he's going through. I can imagine him doing that. Not because he's disagreeing with Matthew, but because he doesn't want to include it in his history for the purpose that he's writing his history. Do you see the point I'm making? So about two-thirds of Matthew, he decides this is great. This is exactly is in the line with what I'm trying to construct. And the rest, I won't bother. Not I won't bother. I don't need in my history. And then he adds a big chunk himself. So he adds even more information than he dropped from Matthew. So good question, like what kind of information did he omit? And what kind of information did he add? Well, I thought it'd be interesting just to look again at the trial with Pilate, because that's actually a great time where we can see both accounts, lots of detail, and we can start asking, assuming Matthew came first, here's the account, which things did Luke decide, I want to keep these and build on them, and which things did he say, I don't want to keep those others? So let's run through. I've done it in a graphical form, and I'll build up. So when Matthew is talking about the trial before Pilate, the Judaic authorities lead Jesus to Pilate. Pilate asks, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus says, "Sulegis," you know, you say, or as you say, or is that what you say? And so that's the first part. Then the Judaic authorities accuse Jesus. There's no answer. Jesus ignores them, doesn't respond to them. Pilate is amazed by that. Pilate asks the crowd who to release because he knew self-interest was behind the charge. While he's there on the judgment throne, his wife interrupts the judgment with a message about a dream, and so it looks like maybe he went off to find out what that message was. Then he comes back, what to do with Messiah, and the crowd shout back, crucify him. And there's an uproar starting. Eventually, Pilate gives in. He washes his hands, I'm innocent of this man's blood. And he releases Barabbas. He orders Jesus flogged and sent to crucifixion. After Jesus dies, Joseph asks for the body. Pilate agrees. And the Judaic authorities ask for a tomb guard. And Pilate says, I'm sure, but you have to supply it. So that's what we have in Matthew. And I can imagine Luke going through, as I say, and thinking about, like, which of these pieces is relevant to the account I'm going to give in my legal deposition, in my affidavit. I think this one, he says, this is actually, I mean, I believe it happened, Luke would say, but how do I prove that it happened? Like Pilate knows that self-interest was behind the charge. I mean, that's kind of hard to verify, yeah? And then there's the uproar starting, and Pilate washes his hands, I'm innocent of his blood. I suspect that's not in the court record. You know, maybe he looks at the court record and like, I can't prove that either. So I could imagine him saying, those things are hard to prove, so if I'm writing a verifiable account, maybe I don't need those. And then there's a bunch that I think he might say, well, this first one, that the Judaic authorities accuse Jesus, and Jesus doesn't answer, and Pilate's amazed, that's not particularly relevant to the case that I'm making. And the whole thing about the dream, well, that's not really relevant. I mean, what will you do in a court of law with the fact that his wife had a dream? And the fact that the Judaic authorities asked for a tomb guard, and they had, you know, again, so I'm guessing, I mean, I know that these are dropped off by Luke. I'm guessing that these might have been the kind of motivations that Luke had to drop them off. So let's take those out. Let's drop those off. And we're left with this. It's gone purple now because Luke is going to include this. And now he's going to add a little material himself. In his gospel, he adds some other things about Pilate that Matthew didn't have. For example, that Pilate was the governor when John the Baptist started preaching. So he's giving some context, some history of Pilate's connectivity with John the Baptist, who Luke has very much connected with Jesus because the whole thing started with John the Baptist in his gospel. And the comment about Pilate having previously put down an insurrection in Galilee. So Pilate was well aware of the challenges that he was having with the Judaic authorities. He then includes this accusation that Jesus opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Messiah, a king. So that's a much more precise charge than was found in Matthew. And presumably, Luke has found that this was actually the charge that was laid and is recording the official charge that is there against Jesus. Then there's a whole part where Pilate declares Jesus innocent. Then Pilate, realizing the crowd is against him, like, how do I get rid of this nightmare, discovers that Jesus is from Herod's jurisdiction, and so says, you know, Herod can deal with it. So he passes the buck over to Herod. And that actually fits with Roman law. When a trial is coming before a governor or somebody like Pilate, They have the opportunity of deciding, if this person comes from that city or that province, I can send them to that province for them to have their trial there by the leader of that province. So in Roman law, he could send Jesus to Herod. Herod has jurisdiction. Let's see what Herod does. And Herod sends him back and says, like, we had fun with him, but we, you know, there was nothing. I couldn't find a basis to accuse him. And from Luke's point of view, this is significant. First of all, Pilate, after doing an initial investigation, it's not clear, like he said, I think he's innocent. He sees the problem. He hands jurisdiction to somewhere else. So Pilate's declared, this guy's innocent of this charge of opposing payments of taxes to Caesar and claiming to be a king. Now Herod has declared Jesus innocent of any of these charges and says, I'm not going to do anything. Back to you, Pilate. And so he comes back. I'm actually kind of amazed that Pilate and Herod became friends on this. I could imagine them saying, like, thanks a lot. You know. And what we get is, again, an explicit statement. Pilate resists for the first time, stating that Jesus is innocent. So here we are. Matthew's account was a completely valid account of what went on, but not complete. Of course, none of the Gospels are complete. None of the Gospels say everything that went on. The whole world wouldn't be big enough to contain all the books that might be written. I think John said that, right? What Matthew had done was constructed a correct account. Luke needs also a correct account, but his purpose is different. And so he drops some things from Matthew and puts some things in that will be relevant for Luke. So I think that sort of thing is interesting. Now, you will be relieved to know, we're not going to go through the whole of Matthew in this level of detail. I just want to show you that one can look at accounts and see some reasonable justification why Luke would leave some things out and add new things. So let's now take a general look at Matthew and Luke. So if Matthew is one of the sources that Luke is using, it would be good to understand why Luke omits some material, why he adds additional material. And remember, the theory we've been proposing is that Luke is intending to demonstrate that Christianity is rooted deep within Judaism, and he will also want to be complete enough to demonstrate that Christianity is no threat to Rome, that it doesn't advocate sedition or violent overthrow or anything like that. And finally, I think Luke will want to omit material that he deems unhelpful to his case or irrelevant to his purpose, or material that doesn't have sufficient independent verification. Again, not that he's disbelieving Matthew, but if he can't prove something independently, he may choose to leave it out. So let's consider the things that he chooses to omit. So this red part is the part of Matthew that doesn't make it into Luke. And so in that part of Matthew, we have the original birth narrative of the shepherds and the magi and all of that going down to Egypt and Matthew's genealogy and so on. Let's think, why might Luke have omitted some of that? It's interesting to note that we noted the other day that the magi cult was prohibited by Rome. It was not a cult that Rome was happy. So maybe not so helpful to mention that these people from this prohibited cult had come and honored Jesus. Okay. And also, the Magi themselves may well have come from Parthia, which was a nation that had been a consistent thorn in Rome's side. So, you know, right at his birth, some enemies of the state come. Like, I mean, it happened, but let's not put it in front of the court. Also, Luke has a very different birth narrative that he wants to give. Again, one that is equally correct, but emphasizes the points he wants to emphasize, and we'll see that in a minute, about Jesus and Christianity being rooted in Judaism. The Old Testament prophecies. Matthew liberally throughout gives lots of Old Testament prophecies and says this was done to fulfill this prophecy. Yeah, but that's Matthew's opinion. I mean, Luke can't prove that it was done to fulfill that prophecy. I mean, how do you verify that? And it's actually not so relevant to a Roman audience. So all of those times where he says, this was done to fulfill this part of the Old Testament, I say all, I haven't been exhaustive in my research here, but I suspect the vast majority of them, maybe all, have been taken out because it's not relevant. Like, it won't make Jesus' case any better, and Paul's case any better, and it's hard to verify. Halfway down, the disciples to go to Israel, not to the Gentiles. Again, it happened. We understand why it happened, but it unnecessarily muddies the case that the Gentiles were always intended to be part of what God included. And so I can imagine Luke saying, I don't need to say that about Jesus. Let's just drop that. I'm going to be arguing for the inclusion of the Gentiles, and I don't want to have to make the case why Jesus said, don't do it, and then the later disciples said, do it. And as I say, we understand that because we've done the work of looking at the phasing of this, that what Jesus was trying to do was, first of all, convert Israel, and only when they rejected him did he move through the apostles to a different phase. There's a couple of things in parenthesis here, Judas' suicide and commission in brackets. I've put those in brackets because versions of these are included in second letter to Theophilus in Acts. The commission will be very similar. The Judas suicide, we'll explore that one in more detail in just a moment. But first of all, he also leaves out the opening of the tombs, the earthquake, the guarding of Jesus' tomb, the bribery, all of those kinds of things. I have no idea why he dropped those. Maybe he doesn't see them as relevant. Maybe he doesn't have enough witnesses to be able to assert it, or that it could be independently verified. But he drops it. The one thing that I think is fascinating is when you compare the account of Judas' suicide in Matthew with the account in Luke's writing in Acts, they look quite different. So let's think about that for a moment. How did Judas meet his end? When Judas, his betrayer, saw that Jesus was condemned, this is Matthew, he repented and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. He said, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. But they said, what is that to us? See to it yourself. Throwing down the pieces of silver in the temple, he departed and he went and hanged himself. But the chief priests, taking the pieces of silver, said, it's not lawful to put them into the treasury since they're blood money. After conferring together, they used them to buy the potter's field as a place to bury foreigners. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. So that's Matthew's account. Luke drops that. He doesn't include that. What he does instead in Acts is he says this. He's now quoting Peter, who was at the stage of saying, we need to find a replacement for Judas. Friends, the scripture had to be fulfilled, which the Holy Spirit through David foretold concerning Judas, who became a guide for those who arrested Jesus, for he was numbered among us and was allotted his chair in the ministry. And now it appears Luke is giving his commentary. Now this man acquired a field with a reward of his wickedness, and falling headlong, he burst open in the middle, and all his bowels gushed out. This became known to the residents of Jerusalem, so that the field was called in their language Hakeldama, that is, field of blood. Two questions. How did Judas die, and why was the field named field of blood? On the face of it, we have two very different accounts. And people who want to find flaws with scripture are often very happy to say, look, it contradicts itself. But even more challenging, I think, is if Luke had Matthew, is Luke actually stating that Matthew was wrong here as he constructs his account? Or I mean, There obviously have been lots of ways where people have tried to join this together. For example, that there's ancient testimony that when Judas tried to hang himself, the rope broke, and that he went around engorged and so on, and then some say, and then he fell over in the field that he had bought, and his guts gushed out. But even so, it's still disagreeing as to why it's called a field of blood. Is it called field of blood because it was bought with blood money, or because there was blood spilt all over it? There's another distinction. Did they buy the money? Did they buy the field with his money, or did he buy the field? I think that's a minor distinction. That's negligible. It was his money that bought the field. They both agree on that. Harry Whittaker had this great analysis of this passage. I don't know if any of you read it in a book of his a long time ago now, of course. He pointed out that this language in Acts, falling headlong, he burst open in the middle and all his bowels gushed out, admits a very different translation in the Greek. And he points out that this Greek can be translated, falling headlong is prostrating himself. In fact, the Book of Maccabees, which was a Greek book written between the Testaments, has the same word used of someone prostrating themselves before God in supplication. So it is falling prone, like a prostrating yourself. The prostrating himself, he shouted out in the midst. We still use the phrase, yeah, he burst out, to mean he shouted something out, don't we? I mean, it's an idiom that we use. The midst is used lots of places, in the midst of the temple, in the midst of the courtyard. Matthew tells us that he was in the temple. And so what Luke may be saying is that he shouted out in the midst, in the crowd of people. That's how that word often gets used. And every other use in Acts is in the middle of something, typically a crowd. And then his bowels gushed out. You remember the phrase, I think it was in the King James, you know, bowels of mercy, and we'd always laugh at that, Colossians 3, verse 12. And where they use the word bowels, we tend to use the word heart now, meaning emotional, thinking about it from that point of view. The falling headlong, prostrating himself, he shouted out in the midst of the temple and poured out his heart. In fact, this thing about his bowels gushed out, we still, you know, in a gangster movie, we still have the phrase, he spilled his guts. We use it as an idiom to confess. And so it seems, I mean, I find this pretty compelling, that what Luke is doing is actually describing the same circumstance that Matthew is describing. So if we put that in there, let's start reading halfway down. Now this man acquired a field with the reward of his wickedness, and prostrating himself, he shouted out in the midst and poured out his heart, and this became known to all the residents of Jerusalem, so that the field that was called in their language Hakeldama, that is, field of blood. And now what we just have is a slightly crisper account in Luke of the same thing that we read in Matthew. I find this compelling. It serves Luke's purpose. It's consistent, and it's just a metaphorical understanding of the language in Greek, as opposed to a literal one, but consistent with how that phrasing gets used elsewhere in the New Testament. So, what we've done then is seen that red part, why those things may have gotten left out. Let's have a look at this blue part to see the things that may have been added, or that were added by Luke, assuming he started out with Matthew. What are the things that Luke considers important to add to his record that wasn't in Matthew's record? Well, here's, again, a representative list. John the Baptist, the birth of Jesus, the temple visits at birth, age 12, and a different genealogy. I'm not going to comment on the differences of the genealogies, partly because I don't have a strong viewpoint on them at the moment. But I do want to emphasize something that I said yesterday. It is still shocking to me, now that I realize it, that the Gospel of Luke starts in the temple. So different than the Gospel of Matthew. Not because one is right and the other is wrong, but the story that they want to tell is different. The first baby born miraculously in Luke is not Jesus. It's John the Baptist. Because John the Baptist is herald in is rooted in Judaism and is the herald of Jesus who is to come. You see, again, the point that he's making, this is rooted in Judaism. Nazareth, the rejection at Nazareth. I find it, Jesus goes into the wilderness. And if you look at how Luke records it, he goes into the wilderness, and then he uses one verse to say, he preached in Capernaum, and then he came to Nazareth. Like the whole of the Capernaum ministry is, oh yeah, he preached in Capernaum, and then he came to Nazareth. And then we get Jesus' message in Nazareth. I don't know if you remember what Jesus' message in Nazareth is. All through the Old Testament, the prophets were rejected by their own people, and they went to the Gentiles. It talks about Elijah doing that, Naaman the Syrian. He gives these examples. And it infuriates everybody in Nazareth, and they want to throw him down. We know the story. Luke picks this as the very first thing of Jesus' ministry that he wants to record. Again, not because he thinks that the Capernaum ministry isn't interesting, but for the case that he's constructing, he can lay that to one side. He just wants to say, this is what happened when Jesus comes to Nazareth. I think there's an interesting inclusivity that Luke is doing. So he talks a lot about women, the widow's son, the women who weep over Jesus' feet, the women who accompany Jesus. And I almost wonder whether it's like, how threatening is this guy to you guys, really? I mean, he's spending all this time working with the women. Like, do you really think that he's about to overthrow your empire? I mean, I don't know. But then he's also, if we go down a couple more, looking very clear about the kind of preaching out, the sending out the 72, the healing on the Sabbath, the Samaritan leper. So this inclusivity, the going to the Samaritans, the Zacchaeus, the parable of the Good Samaritan. It's only there in Luke. It's not in I mean, what an incredible parable. And thanks for your exhortation. Yes, but what an incredible parable. Luke's the only one who tells us about it. And it must be because Luke had a particular interest in what that showed about Jesus. Another incredible parable, the Pharisee and the tax collector. I wonder if that's relevant for Luke's purpose. Well, clearly it is. Paul is in trouble with the Judaic authorities. Let's see what Jesus talked about those who held themselves as very religious, this Pharisee party. Something else. The disciples had swords. Yeah, they had two of them. Like, you know, if they were going to arm themselves, surely they would have managed at least 12 or 13 of them. Again, I think Luke's point is to be clear that this is not a rebellious organization. They just had two swords. Emmaus, the road to Emmaus, only in Luke. What's the point of the road to Emmaus? Well, one to us beautifully is the witnesses of the resurrected Christ. But actually the point of the story is that the Jewish scriptures foretold that Christ would suffer. That was the thing that he opened their eyes to. That's what Luke is emphasizing there. Again, Christianity is Judaism. So consistently, we can see that the choice of Luke's material is oriented towards the three defenses. Christianity is no threat against Rome. Christians are not the cause of rioting and violence. And Christianity is rooted in Judaism. Christianity is Judaism. So I find this actually quite a compelling way to understand this aspect of why Luke should leave out things in Matthew and why he should add additional things. So let's go back to the full chart. Just while we're all here together, let's take a moment to notice what's unique to Mark. Mark has many small refinements to other people's accounts, exactly what you might expect from an eyewitness. It's got Jesus' family trying to restrain him. I love the thing with the little girl, Talita Kumi, little girl, arise, little girl, sit up. One of the most beautiful things. And Peter witnessed that. And Peter would have talked about how meaningful that was to him. There's this lovely one of the young man running naked from Gethsemane. And people have often speculated, it's only in Mark. Maybe it was Mark. Maybe that was the one thing that he witnessed. Maybe he was there around. We know he lived in Jerusalem. So maybe that was Mark. And he talks about the disciples being afraid. So I find that interesting. We're not going to make a big deal of any of that. Let's go back to some of the ancient witnesses. Matthew has a richer story behind it. Irenaeus, from the mid to late 100s, says this. Matthew also issued a written gospel among the Hebrews in their own dialect, that is Aramaic, while Peter and Paul were preaching at Rome and laying the foundations of the church. After their departure, that is, after Peter and Paul were killed, Mark, and they were killed in about 65-ish. After their departure, Mark, the disciple and interpreter of Peter, did also hand down to us in writing what had been preached by Peter. So that's consistent with what we've seen. Then he also says, Luke, also the companion of Paul, recorded in a book the gospel preached by him. Afterwards, John, the disciple of the Lord, who also had leaned upon his breast, did himself publish a gospel during his residence at Ephesus in Asia. So the thing I want to pick up here is that Matthew was originally, there was a version of it in Aramaic. And indeed, if we look at Papias, our friend from earlier, who was talking to the disciples and so on, he himself says Matthew composed the oracles in the Hebrew language, and each one interpreted them as he could. And Irenaeus elsewhere says, the gospel according to Matthew was written to the Jews, for they laid particular stress upon the fact that Christ should be the seed of David. Matthew also, who had a still greater desire to establish this point, took particular pains to afford them convincing proof that Christ is of the seed of David, and therefore he commences with an account of his genealogy. So I find that fascinating, that there seems to have been an early version of the Gospel of Matthew that was written in Aramaic. What happened to it? Here's some guy called George Clark writing 150 years ago. He says, all the versions that we have, even the Peshitto Syriac, the language in which the gospel is said to have been originally written, conform to the present Greek text. All the quotations of the early writers are from the Greek copy of Matthew's gospel. It should be further noted that although so many of the early writers assert that Matthew originally wrote his gospel in Hebrew, yet we do not find that any of them ever used it or saw it. Hence, if there ever was a Hebrew copy, it must have been lost very early, soon after the destruction of Jerusalem. So it looks as though there was a copy of Matthew in Hebrew, in Aramaic, and then Matthew reworked it and produced a much fuller version in Greek. That's not surprising. We know a similar thing of Josephus. Josephus apparently wrote his Wars of the Jews in Aramaic first, and then secured the help of Greek writers in freely reproducing and improving it in the Greek language. And we only have the Greek edition that's come down to us. We have references to the Hebrew thing, but we don't actually have copies of the Hebrew version. In the same way, we have references to the Hebrew version of Matthew. We don't have any copies of it. What are the dates? Well, tradition is that after 15 years of preaching in Palestine, Matthew left for foreign nations, but left behind his Hebrew gospel as a kind of compensation for his absence. Now, if that's true, the Hebrew version would have been dated around 45 AD, which is shockingly soon after the things of Christ. And so then we would consider possibly in the 50s, the expanded Greek version, which pick up many of Jesus' teachings that were originally in Greek. So I find that quite exciting when you start piecing together this two gospel hypothesis. In fact, if we put the pieces together, it suggests this Hebrew version of Matthew existed from about 45 AD, and then it got expanded in the 50s for the expanded Greek version. And then Luke had access to that in the late 50s, early 60s, produced his gospel in preparation for Paul's trial, and then produced his Acts as the second volume that he's writing to Theophilus. And then Mark, probably around 65, 66 AD, around the time of Peter's martyrdom, recorded the record of Peter's personal witness. And then John, I actually think there's a good case to be made that John's gospel was also before AD 70, because John says there is in Jerusalem a pool in Siloam. He does not say there was in Jerusalem a pool in Siloam. So I find this a good approach to the first objection, the evidence that Luke's gospel could well have been written in exactly the right period. And the two gospel hypothesis is undergoing a resurgence in theological circles. This is a recent book that has been pretty highly regarded, Rethinking the Dates of the New Testament, and is making the case that essentially the whole of the New Testament was written before AD 70. And by no means have academics said, yes, we now hold that to be true, but it's viable. There are two viable views in theological circles for this. So we have the second objection still, the religious content. Why would the trial need anything of what's in the gospel? And we'll leave that for later. And we'll finish there. Thanks.